This is Eugene Beer reporting for the Conscious Voices program at the Conference on Racism here at Ohio State University, and I'm speaking outside here today with...
Rami.
You are with CJP, right?
Correct. Committee for Justice in Palestine.
You know, I'm Jewish, and I grew up in a Jewish family. I visited Israel back in the 80s. My mom always told me, well, Israel's a place where Jews from around the world can go, and no matter what, have a place to live. And I thought as a kid, you know, wow, that's so cool. But then when I visited Israel in the 80s, I saw that it was not just white-skinned Jews that lived there. And I was interested in your perspective that you aired in the conference right here.
You know, being that the state of Israel is self-defined as the state for the Jewish people, you obviously are going to have vastly different rights as a Jewish person in this world than anyone else. And for example, if you are Jewish, if you have citizenship in any country in the world, if you show up, you know, at the gate in the airport at Tel Aviv, you can apply for citizenship, you'll be granted citizenship, and you will be allowed to live in Israel. Now, if you're a Palestinian, especially a descendant of a refugee family, you can't even get within 100 miles of the airport to even apply for citizenship, you know?
You can't even fly into Tel Aviv?
You can't even fly into Tel Aviv. You know, like, for example, my family were expelled from their home in 1948 in the middle of the night at gunpoint. And since then, they became refugees in 1948. They moved to a different house after the 48 war. And in 1967, all the men in my family became refugees for the second time, because they were all slated for execution or prison. And so they fled. And now they're spread out around the world.
And they were slated for execution because they were fighting against the Israeli army?
I mean, if you want to call it fighting against the Israeli army, honestly, what it was they were handing out political pamphlets. They were handing out political pamphlets, and they were moving food to fighters in the neighborhood. And this is what was going to get them killed, and this is what was going to get them thrown in jail. But, I mean, if you really want to look at this in the simplest way, the best way I can highlight this for you is if you look at my father, who was kicked out of that home, okay? Let's say you live in Columbus, and you're a person of Jewish descent. You can actually go move to Israel, get your citizenship, and go live in the house that my father and his family were kicked out of, when none of them can go anywhere near it. That's the absurdity of this. That's why, you know, Israeli law and you know, this method of population control is inherently racist. And I do understand, you know, you were talking about your mother and the Israeli dream, and I do understand what that means to people. You know, if you identify with a group who's been persecuted for so many thousands of years, it's really powerful to be able to feel that inside of you, you know, where I have a place where I belong. The point, though, is that a lot of people like you, who when they actually see what the cost of that is, for the Palestinian inhabitants, who the Israeli state was built on top of, when you see that, you realize this is not okay. You know, I had this dream. It's not utopia here. I mean, and it's not even just between Israelis and Palestinians. There's the racial divisions inside the state of Israel are very, very severe, very severe, and it's not covered much because, you know, there's the whole backdrop of the war on the Palestinians, but you have so many different classes, you know, not directly written into law, but pretty well recognized within society. You know, at the top you have Jews of European descent. After them, you have Jews of other national descents, whether they're from Africa, from other Arab countries, anywhere else. Right. Below that, you have Palestinians, they're called Arab Israelis, who are basically Palestinians who didn't leave their homes in 1948. That's not to say that they're actually in their homes, because a lot of them are internally displaced refugees, but they didn't leave what became, in its mythical borders, the State of Israel. That's the third class. Then you have Palestinians living in the West Bank, you know, who you might want, you wouldn't normally think of them as citizens of the state of Israel because they don't have citizenship, but they are effectively under the jurisdiction of the Israeli government.
Were they pushed into the West Bank?
Right. Well, a lot of the population of the West Bank are refugees. The place where that is even more true is in the Gaza Strip. Now, when you look at Gaza, you have to look at it in context. This isn't a group of people who are living on this strip of land and woke up one day and decided, we want to kill Israelis, we want to kill Jews. 75% of the population in the Gaza Strip are refugees. These are people who were forced out of their homes in 1948. And, you know,
Some in 1967.
And some in 1967. Population growth obviously is exponential. So now there are 1.5 million people now, 75% of whom are descendants of refugees. So when you look at what the people of Gaza are living through and what their aspirations are, it's not just to eternally fight the Israelis or to eternally fight the Jews. This is about them going home. This is about them going to your homes. Now, if you ask someone in the Gaza Strip, let's say he lives in Khan Yunis refugee camp, you know, if you ask him where he's from, he's not going to tell you I'm from this area of the camp. He's going to tell you I'm from Mejdal, you know, which is a city that was completely depopulated. And he's going to tell you he's from any one of these villages that were destroyed. The Palestinian people, we haven't forgotten where we come from. We are very much a population that lives in exile. We are very much a refugee population. And to understand the dynamics of the situation, you need to recognize that. You know, you need to recognize that if you allow some sovereignty for Palestinians, the problem is not fixed. This is at its root a problem based on people being expelled from their land. And until they're allowed to return to the land, until I can return to my family's home and live there, until people in camps in the Gaza Strip can return to where they're from, until people in camps in Lebanon, in Syria, and Jordan can return to where they're from, there's no solution. There's absolutely no solution. And, you know, that's where people start to think, like, this can never end. But it can. It's really simple. You give people their basic rights, and this all ends. You allow people their legal right to return to their homes. You allow them their legal right to vote for a government that's going to represent them. And this ends.
But returning to their homes would not be accomplished with a two-state solution, would it?
Absolutely not. The you know, on top of all the other problems with the two-state solution, if you just want to highlight the refugee issue, there is absolutely no solution to the refugee issue with the two-state solution, which is part of the reason why Camp David in 2000 failed, among a lot of other reasons. That's one of the reasons. But there's just no way. I mean, the most that Israel has ever offered, you know, as if this is their privilege to offer, has been in the future Palestinian state for refugees to return to that state. You know, and in that implying that they're still going to be controlling immigration and borders into that future Palestinian state. But there's never been any mention of Palestinians being allowed to return to what's now Israel, where their homes are. Never. That's not even a topic up for debate, which is the first bridge that needs to be broken here, is the refugee issue.
Do you think the Israelis, in their attempt to ensure that never again will the Holocaust happen, that they think they have some leeway in the world community to have this pure state? I hear that so many times.
Right.
You know, because of the Holocaust, we have a special reason for doing this.
Right.
What's your view on that?
I do agree with you that does stifle a lot of criticism of Israel in the world. When you do, you know, there's been a very successful movement to equate thoughts against the Israeli government as thoughts against the Jewish people, or anti-Zionist as anti-Semitic. And I do agree with you. It's helped to stifle criticism around the world. What's important to note, though, is that the colonization of Palestine started before the Holocaust. You know, and to recognize that, and to recognize the displacement of the Palestinians, in no way means you need to deny the Jewish Holocaust. You know, if you go talk to a random Palestinian, if you go talk to someone in my family, they're going to say, yeah, of course it happened, but we had nothing to do with it. why are we paying the price for this? And on top of that, you know, the racist policies and the colonization started way before the Jewish Holocaust. You know, the British government, who had colonial control over Palestine in 1917, when it wasn't their right, actually gave the land of Palestine, the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour, actually offers the land of Palestine to the Jewish people. This is decades before the Jewish Holocaust. And this is when, you know, immigration from Europe starts to happen, and this is the beginning of the displacement, years before the Holocaust. So, you know, recognizing the Jewish Holocaust doesn't mean you can't recognize the exile of Palestinians and the brutality of the occupation.
Exactly, yes. How long have you been with CJP here in Ohio State?
I've been with CJP since I was a freshman here. It was 2004.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. You're very articulate, and it's good to hear all sides of this issue.
Thanks to you, too. Thank you.
I'm talking with Wendy Aik from CJP at Ohio State University. Wendy, tell us why you're volunteering for this organization and what it means to you.
Hi, Eugene. I just wanted to correct one thing. I'm no longer working with CJP, not for any political reason or anything. I'm just working with the Divestment Support Committee now, and I just don't want to take credit for all the work that they're doing right now when I haven't helped out.
I know you have been very active in the past, and I've always heard your name associated with it. But you were actually over in Palestine for a while a couple years ago. What was your experience like over there?
Right after I graduated from college is when I went to Palestine. I had been working with CJP on campus when I was an undergraduate here. I went to Palestine when I got a job with Bedil, which is an NGO in the West Bank in Bethlehem, which deals specifically with refugee rights issues. I'm very interested in refugee rights issues because I think it gets to the heart of what the central issue is that needs to be resolved in order to bring peace and have any sort of justice in the area.
It seems like there's no refugee rights right now. Where can one even begin to have equality in that area?
Right. There are no refugee rights that Israel grants to Palestinian refugees. However, when it's state verbiage about its immigration policy and its citizenship policies, it has a large, they term aliyah, right of return, for all worldwide Jews are able to return to Israel. They make the argument and say it's because the Jews lived there thousands of years ago and every worldwide Jew is initially from that area. Therefore, they're allowed to make return to that area. But they do not grant the same rights to return to people who were living there for generations up until 61 years ago. As far as this can be realized, you're right. There are very few groups who discuss refugee rights issues as a center point for this conflict. Usually it's about two-state or one-state argument. It's about the terms of a two-state solution. It's about the security of Israel. They frame it in a lot of different ways to obscure the fact that the main point is that Israel was created to be a state for the Jewish people, not for the citizens of the country or the people residing within its borders. And to maintain that, it's important for there to be a Jewish majority population in order to have this Jewish character of the state. That was the initial reason for the expulsion of, as Benny Morris says, 750,000 refugees in 1948 as the war. So typically when a lot of, and you can't make the argument that nation states don't start themselves with wars. I mean, this is something that unfortunately happens. But the point of the refugee problem that was created with this war specifically was that those refugees were never meant to return because they needed to clear out so that there was a Jewish majority population for the state to have its Jewish character. And that's what is the problem as far as having a very ethnic discriminatory policy is in the state that have been subsequent to 1948.
Do you think the citizens of Israel, the Jewish citizens, are in alignment with their government on this, or is there a lot of dissension, a lot of opposing viewpoint?
Well, there's a lot of language with the two-state solution and what that means. And people ask, are you for or against a two-state solution? And that kind of is used as a metering stick for people. But a lot of majority of Israelis right now, according to polls that are published in Haaretz newspapers, indicate that the majority of Israelis are in support of a two-state solution. They feel that ending the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip will bring some amount of security to the country that they've been looking for and craving, and that it also provides justice to the people and Palestinians living in those areas. One thing that those polls don't indicate is exactly what two-state solution they're talking about. There's a lot of different versions and definitions of what that two-state will be. Will it be a two-state solution where there's West Bank and Gaza Strip as the Palestinian state, and then Israel, the borders of Israel remain Israel, and refugees return to Israel, or they return to West Bank and Gaza? If they're expected, the refugees, to only return to West Bank and Gaza, that's an impossibility. There are more than 6 million refugees, Palestinian refugees, that have legitimate claims under international law to return. And if they are only allowed to return to the territories of West Bank and Gaza, that's essentially denying them any rights.
I had no idea it was such a large number, 6 million. Now, where are most of these refugees right now?
There are Palestinian refugees living in refugee camps in West Bank and Gaza, and Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, especially in southern Lebanon. There are also refugees, of course, living in diaspora all over the world right now, especially in Latin America. But there's a Palestinian president of a Latin American country, oddly enough. There's not a Palestinian state, but there's a Palestinian president of a different country.
It seems like the U.S. government has always been very pro-Israel, one administration after the next. What's the organization that you hear about in the United States that's a strong lobby for Israel?
AIPAC.
Yeah, AIPAC. Do you know anything about this lobby? How strong is it? Is that perhaps why the administrations are so much pro-Israel?
Well, there's within the people who discuss the problems with having AIPAC be such a powerful lobbying agency in the United States, there's different arguments about how much that impacts the U.S. policy and whether or not Israel dictates to the U.S., whether or not the United States supports it, or whether U.S. dictates to Israel that it is going to be supported. It's probably a combination of both. As we know, in lots of other industries, such as energy and now the health insurance companies, lobbying agencies do make a large difference in U.S. policy. But I think it's probably both, a little mix of both. Israel is a very friendly state to the U.S. and the region, and it's important for the United States to have something in the region it can rely on as a stable partner. And Israel would not be able to enact the kind of devastation that it wreaked upon Gaza earlier this year if the United States were not supporting it, and if the United States did not continue to support it. A lot of people had hoped that President Obama would not renew the additional funding package to Israel. However, that's not the case. Seymour Hersh has written articles about the siege on Gaza being ended when Obama's interim team phoned Israel and said, we will not be having a siege on Gaza when we're inaugurating our new president, Obama. And so they ended the siege on Gaza a week prematurely, if you look into Israeli documents about what the plans were for the military at the time. They were going to continue the siege and escalate the land invasion for an additional week. So there is a lot of dictating that the United States can do to Israel. But the most important thing that the United States could do to help Palestinians and human rights in the area is to make suspensions on its aid, its foreign military aid, to Israel, which without which Israel would not be able to intimidate and enact the policies that it does.
Exactly. Regarding Iran, we see Israel posturing as if it's going to attack Iran, not allowing it to procure a nuclear weapon. Ahmadinejad has been very loosely translated, probably incorrectly, that he would like to see Israel wiped off the face of the earth or wiped off the map. I think he said more precisely, the Israeli government needs to disappear from power. Do you think Israel has a legitimate reason to go attacking Iran for this purpose?
I think the speech you're referring to, Ahmadinejad, was mistranslated as far as other Farsi scholars have said on that point. However, Ahmadinejad has done things that completely complicate the issue and do not help anything. He's had conferences where he invites Holocaust deniers to give presentations. He's very problematic to having any kind of good policy between Israel and Iran, obviously. However, Israel does not face an existential threat from Iran. Israel is the military superpower in the region. It's one of the largest militaries in the world. I mean, we saw the display of its power in Gaza recently. It's using white phosphorus weapons. It has a full arsenal at its disposal and full military support from the U.S. for whatever it can possibly request. So there's obviously no existential threat that it faces on that level.
Yes, of course, a single nuclear weapon exploded in a city like Tel Aviv would be very disastrous.
Which is to say that Israel's nuclear weapons might not want to detonate where they store them, which is in the Palestinian centers in northern Israel, which is one of the issues when Israel was bombing Lebanon in 2006. Israel has state claims against it now for using Palestinians as human shields because all of its weapons depots, including its nuclear arsenal, which Israel is a superpower with nuclear weapons, all of their weapons depots are located in Palestinian concentrated villages in the north of Israel, so that if it were ever going to be targeted by someone else's military, the first targets were obviously in a campaign such as that are nuclear arsenals and war, so they would be targeting Palestinian villages.
Well, thank you so much for talking. It's a very complex issue. Ongoing discussion throughout the community is always very welcome on community radio. Thank you, Wendy Aik, here at the Conference on Racism and Capitalism at Ohio State University.